Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today and the lead story around the world is President Donald Trump has tested positive for the coronavirus. What does that mean? First of all, it's going to throw national politics into disarray and chaos, but perhaps there's some lessons we can learn about this as well, because the coronavirus is much easier to catch than most people realize, and its effects could be devastating, especially in this case for national politics. Also, there's a new vaccine that people are talking about, one by Johnson & Johnson. So that means there are now four major contenders for a vaccine later this year and perhaps early next year. But this one is different. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you only have to take it once, not twice. And it uses tried and true methods that have been used historically against other viruses, rather than using experimental methods that haven't been tested. And speaking about science, we're going to say a few things about the weather and energy. There's a new study coming out. For the first time, we have a detailed analysis of the future of the South Pole. If the South Pole melts one day because of global warming, we're talking about the rise in sea level approaching 200 vertical feet. In other words, the coastline of the Earth will be unrecognizable if the South Pole melts. And they did a computer study to show exactly at what levels of temperature must be reached in order to begin this melting process. So in other words, we have bad news concerning the South Pole. It is much more vulnerable than we previously thought. And there's a point of no return where the melting becomes irreversible. But speaking about energy, we'll also say a few things about new research from MIT. First of all, in France, we have the European Union and the United States and Russia backing the ITER fusion reactor. Perhaps fusion power is the power of the future, the power to replace fossil fuels. In fact, seawater. Seawater would be the basic ingredient for a fusion reactor, but the ITER reactor in France is, well, long overdue. It's expensive, and of course, there's cost overruns. Now MIT has a new dark horse in the running. It's called SPARC. The SPARC fusion reactor, they think, will hit break-even much sooner than expected, and perhaps it could be, just could be, a game-changer. Well, let's just jump right into some of the big stories of the past week. The big story today, of course, is the fact that President Donald Trump has tested positive for the coronavirus, and that puts the whole national political scene in disarray. The debates, the rallies, the speeches, all of that is now up for grabs, and people are now beginning to dust off their copies of the Constitution. Now, most doctors would say that there's a good chance, an excellent chance, that Donald Trump will come out of this smelling like a rose. After all, the death rate is not 100%, it's only 1%. However, it does mean that we have to look at all sorts of different kinds of options. So, people are taking a look at the Constitution to find out what the succession of power would be if the president becomes incapacitated. Well, however, what we're going to do today for exploration is to try to bring it home, because the coronavirus we now realize is much more contagious than the flu virus and much more deadly in terms of the number of people it kills. In fact, it is about 10 times more lethal than the seasonal flu virus. And the question is, well, what are we going to do about it? I mean, what kind of precautions should we take given the fact that every few weeks, new guidelines and new research is being added? So we're going to summarize really quick what you should do to protect yourself, given the fact that it's much easier to contract the virus than previously thought. Well, of course, everybody knows the drill now, and that is social distance 6 feet, wash your hands, and wear masks. But since then, there have been a lot of other corrections being made that are not yet part of national strategy. First of all, 6 feet is not enough. 6 feet should be a minimum of 6 feet, because aerosols, that is tiny little droplets of a vapor that you can barely see, aerosols can spread the virus not just 6 feet, but 26 feet. So we're talking about perfume, smoke, as an example of how aerosols can spread. So in other words, 6 feet, yeah, for the most part, try to separate 6 feet, but that's a minimum. Second of all, wear a mask, of course, but wear glasses if you have a chance, because it turns out that the virus can float in the air and, even with a mask, enter your tear ducts, because you have lots of water-soluble liquids in your eyeball, and that's where the virus can enter. In fact, some doctors have noticed the fact that when they examine their patients, they find out that almost none of their patients wear glasses. People who wear glasses have a much lower rate of contracting the coronavirus. Now, of course, you may want to put a face shield around too, but at least glasses. Next, stay outdoors rather than indoors. The dilution factor is enormous when you go outside. And this means, even though restaurants and bars and hair salons are gradually opening up, if there's no circulation of air, don't go in. It's simply not worth the risk, because the dilution factor could one day save your life. Because in close quarters, you're talking about recycling the air over and over again. Now, ideally, for example, in an airplane, we would like to have ultraviolet radiation kill the virus, but not everyone has that. Not every bar, restaurant, or hair salon has an ultraviolet filter by which to kill the virus. So in other words, for the most part, better to stay outdoors than indoors. Next, if you are next to people, stay away from people who are singing, chanting, making loud noises. It turns out that you release thousands of droplets of water vapor carrying the virus every time you sneeze and simply talk. We now realize that simple talking is sufficient to spread the virus, and you want to reduce the length of time you talk to people. Yes, sometimes you have to talk to people. When you pay the cashier, you got to talk to people. But keep it to a minimum, because long conversations will spread the virus. In other words, keep the viral load down if you can. And if you have pets, believe it or not, treat them like family members. Put them as part of your social bubble. Isolate them so they don't spread the virus to other animals, because yes, even pets can get the virus. And then the next question is, let's say you do all these things, but you test positive. What should you do? Well, for the most part, self-quarantine yourself. Chances are you will survive. Chances are it's going to be a horrible experience, but chances are, especially if you're young, you'll come out smelling like a rose. But then the next question is, when do you check in to a hospital after you self-quarantine? We now realize that people wait too long. By the time they go to the hospital, they can barely breathe, and they are put on a ventilator, and then they die. 90%, up to 90% of the people put on ventilators eventually die. And scientists now know the reason why. It turns out that when you are still able to breathe normally, even though with a strain, you think that you can gut it out. You think that it's just an inconvenience, the fact that you're having a hard time breathing. But actually, you could be near death. You need to buy something called an oximeter. That is an oxygen meter. It's a very simple device. It's about 1 inch long, costs about $50. readily available on the internet. And the oximeter shoots rays of light through your finger to measure how much radiation goes through your finger. And of course, this is light radiation, so it's perfectly harmless. And that's how we tell how much oxygen there is in your blood. Regular blood that's oxygenated is bright red. However, blood, once it's depleted of oxygen, becomes bluish, and it's very easy to detect with an oximeter. Normally, the oximeter should read 98% to 100%. Once it starts to drop, even though you can breathe, once it starts to drop to 90%, 80%, the alarm bells should go off. That's when you should call your doctor, tell the doctor what your oximeter reading is, and if it starts to go near 80 or so, talk to your doctor, of course. You may want to check in to a hospital, even if you think you can gut it out, because you're actually very close to death. That's one reason why we have such a high mortality rate, even with people on ventilators. Now, let's say you go to the hospital. Then what do they do at the hospital? Well, there's no cure for the virus, so they have therapeutics which are being used rather successfully in the hospital. It's not a cure, but there are three main types of therapeutics that have shown their effectiveness, not to cure the virus, but to control it. First, convalescent plasma. That is taking the plasma from individuals that have survived the coronavirus and taking that plasma and injecting it into another person. So you benefit from the antibodies which are known to attack the coronavirus. Second, remdesivir. Remdesivir is a chemical. It's not a cure, but it reduces the time that you are spent in a hospital. Why is that important? Because the longer you spend in a hospital, the greater the chances of death. So you want to reduce the time in the hospital as much as you can. But of course, remdesivir is not a cure. Then there is something which actually reduces the death rate. It's not a cure, but it can reduce the death rate up to 50% in some cases. It's dexamethasone. It's a steroid. We now realize that for the most part, the virus does not kill you. That's strange. But yes, the virus itself does not kill you. The virus sets off your immune system for the most part. Your immune system overreacts and attacks the virus, but it attacks your bodily organs, causing organ failure and all sorts of horrible problems. So in other words, it's friendly fire that kills many of the people afflicted with the coronavirus. Steroids. Steroids can reduce the response. Now, the steroids have to be given very carefully. If you give it too soon, then, of course, the immune system is compromised and you get an even bigger dose of the virus. You want to do it late in the game so that you don't have what is called a cytokine storm or this friendly fire which kills you and is basically your own body killing itself. And so that's something to look into. And further down the horizon, there's a new therapy being looked at with tremendous amount of hope. We talked about convalescent plasma, but that requires a person who survived the coronavirus and then willingly donates his blood and plasma for the next victim. But wouldn't it be better if we could somehow artificially grow tons and tons of the antibodies without having to wait for a human being to generate these antibodies? Yes, that's called monoclonal antibodies. And so this is something that you're going to hear more and more of as time goes by. Monoclonal antibodies takes the antibodies generated from a healthy person and clones it. That's right, clones it. So we have almost unlimited copies of this life-saving antibody, much larger than the concentration of the original patient. So this is something that's being looked at, and it's still experimental. It's not widely available, but it's something to think about. Monoclonal antibodies using biotechnology to amplify, multiply the antibodies found in plasma as a safeguard against the coronavirus. And we also point out that there's new hope concerning trying to understand why some people are totally asymptomatic. In fact, some people, up to 50% in fact, never show any symptoms of the virus at all. Why? Well, we're not sure, but there are two theories that are being tested in hospitals. One is that the people that are susceptible to the virus, like people who are obese, have more ACE2 receptors. You see, a virus tries to attack your cells in your lungs, but it has to have a key that unlocks the protective mechanism of your lung cells. So the key is called the spike. That's why it's called the coronavirus. Those are the spikes on the surface of the coronavirus because it looks like a corona. But the key has to go into a lock. That lock is called the ACE2 receptor, and it turns out that certain people have more of these locks than the average person. People who are obese, for example, people with underlying conditions, sometimes have more of these locks than normal. And so other people have very few of these locks, and that's one reason why, for example, women may be less susceptible to the virus than men, and that obese people are more susceptible than people who are not. So that's something that is being looked at very carefully. Next, the common cold. You see, the coronavirus is not just COVID-19. It turns out that there are other varieties of the coronavirus found in the common cold. And when you get the common cold, you build up antibodies, and some of these antibodies scientists think can protect you against COVID-19. And so that could explain why is it that some people are just totally asymptomatic, even though, of course, they could spread the virus. In fact, it's believed that some of the super spreaders, that in fact hundreds of people, are some of these people who are immune to the virus themselves, but are carriers of the virus. And of course, people are awaiting the vaccine. And there's a new candidate that's causing a certain buzz in the medical community. Right now, we have three contenders for the vaccine, one from Oxford, other one from the Moderna Corporation, and Pfizer. However, there's now a fourth entry from Johnson & Johnson. They are going to test not just 30,000. They're going to test 60,000 people in phase 3 trials. And the vaccine that they're proposing is a tried and true vaccine. You see, the tried and true method is to take a virus, either weaken it or kill it, and then develop antibodies for it. That's the tried and true method against polio and many other kinds of diseases. It takes longer, though, to do that. The other companies like Moderna and Pfizer, they take a piece of the virus, clone it, and create antibodies against that piece, which they think is sufficient to nullify the entire virus. It's not been tested. We have never tested a vaccine that targets a piece of a virus. And so that's why the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, even though it's later in the game, is very interesting. Instead of testing 30,000 people, they're going to test 60,000 people. So the conclusion is that by the end of this year, and certainly by mid next year, over 100,000 people will be tested for the vaccine to make sure they have no harmful side effects. Also, let me say some things about the South Pole. We've had a number of programs on exploration about the South Pole, but of course, computer simulations of the disintegration of the South Pole are few and far between. Here's a new report that's being published even as we speak, giving us the first detailed look at what computer simulations show about the South Pole. First of all, why should you care? It's just nothing but a bunch of penguins on the South Pole, right? Well, it's more than penguins, because you see, the South Pole controls most of the weather on the planet Earth and contains over half the entire freshwater content of the planet. And if it were to melt, and of course no one's going to say that it's going to happen anytime soon, but if it were to melt, sea levels would rise 200 feet. Now, for every 1 foot vertical rise of the oceans, you lose 100 times that in terms of coastline. So in other words, if you have sea level rising by 200 feet, this means that the coastline is going to lose 20,000 feet or 4 miles of the coastline. In other words, the coastline starts to look unrecognizable if the South Pole were to completely melt. And that actually happened 34 million years ago. There was no South Pole at all because it was much hotter 34 million years ago. Well, these computer studies show the following, that if the warming above industrial levels rises 1% and keeps on going into the next century, then we're talking about the ultimate collapse of Western Antarctica, meaning that huge chunks, not just little slivers, but huge chunks of West Antarctica will begin to break off. So that's going to be the beginning of the end for the South Pole. If it were to rise, if temperatures were to rise 9 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, then we're talking about whole cities, New Orleans, Tokyo, New York, Boston. Most cities would be underwater. And just realize that over half the population of the planet is near the coastline. And that's in case of a 9-degree rise. We're talking about the end of civilization as we know it. But the computer program goes on. If you have 11 to 16-degree rise, which of course is quite severe, then 70% of the entire South Pole will melt. And if you have an 18-degree rise, you have 100% of the South Pole rising, meaning that the coastline of the planet Earth will be unrecognizable. Now realize that the North Pole is already melting at a very fast rate. Submarines that had visited the North Pole 50 years ago measured the thickness of the ice, and submarines that visit the North Pole today find there's been a reduction of 50% over 50 years. In other words, the North Polar region is losing 1%. 1% of its ice every year. So in other words, at Christmas time, children will say, there's no Santa Claus, because how can Santa Claus live on the North Pole when there is no North Pole? Everybody knows that. Well, the South Pole is where most of the water, fresh water, is located. It's huge, much bigger than the North Polar region. We used to think it was pretty stable, but now we have computer studies showing that if you have as much as an 18-degree Fahrenheit rise in temperature, you have a complete melt of the South Pole. Now, again, no one's saying that this is going to happen anytime soon. We're talking about decades into the future, into the next century. But these effects could be irreversible, meaning that even if we were to go down to pre-industrial levels, we would not be able to reverse the warming of the South Pole. Well, then the next question is, what can we do about it? Well, there is a dark horse. People are betting on solar, the electric car. They're betting on renewable technologies. But there is something that we physicists have looked into, and that is fusion power, the power of the sun. Now, we're not talking about fission power, which, of course, devastated Chernobyl, devastated Fukushima and Three Mile Island. That's fission power, the power of uranium, which is in some sense unnatural. Nowhere in the known universe does nature use uranium for heating purposes. The sun, the stars, they use fusion, that is, hydrogen power. By squeezing hydrogen, you can convert some of the hydrogen into helium, and the excess mass turns into energy by Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared. Well, now at MIT, we have a new candidate for a fusion machine. Now, first of all, let me be clear. There's a joke that every 20 years, we physicists say that fusion is just 20 years around the corner. It never happens. Well, this could be for real. The people at MIT have what they call the SPARC fusion reactor. They think in 4 years, a record, in 4 years, they will achieve break even. That is, creating as much energy as you put into it. Now, right now, we are below break even with the ITER fusion reactor in southern France. That's a $10 billion fusion reactor sponsored by the European Union and the United States, Korea, South Korea, and Japan. And so we're talking about billions of dollars, about $10 billion going into the ITER. However, that uses old technology. Some people are saying that with superconductors and recent advances, that we could do it with a much smaller reactor and still hit break even. And that's the hope of the MIT group. The MIT group is saying that, well, we don't have it yet, but we can see the light at the end of the tunnel that is squeezing hydrogen gas to tens of millions of degrees centigrade, approaching the temperature of the inside of the sun, in fact, colliding hydrogen atoms together to fuse to create helium and copious amounts of energy. It's clean. It uses seawater, not uranium, seawater as its basic fuel, does not create horrible amounts of nuclear waste. It's an ideal form of energy. The only problem is it's quite complicated and we don't have one yet. However, the people at MIT are now in the running, claiming that, cross your fingers, in 4 years' time, we could attain break-even. That is, the power of the sun, the power of the stars on the Earth, in a machine that uses seawater as its basic fuel, does not create tremendous quantities of nuclear waste, and cannot melt down. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics, inviting you to the second half when we talk about biotechnology. The reason why we know so much about the genetics of the virus is because of advances in biotechnology. So with us today is Dr. Robert Lonza, one of the pioneers in the subject, talking about the science of biotechnology. You know, back in 1918, science was caught totally unprepared for one of the greatest pandemics in modern times, the 1918 Spanish flu virus, which killed more people than World War I. At that point, we didn't know where it came from, we didn't know what it was, we didn't have any therapeutics or vaccine. We just had to cross our fingers and let it rip. Well, millions, of course, were affected by that horrible virus of 1918. But today, because of biotechnology, we know an avalanche of information about the virus. We've sequenced the genes. We know its weak spots. We know how it mutates. We're beginning to develop therapeutics in order to exploit the weak spots in the virus. And soon, hopefully, we'll have a vaccine that will then protect the majority of the population. So it's all due to biotechnology. So with us today to discuss the advances in biotechnology is one of the leaders in biotechnology, Dr. Robert Lonza, who is credited as being one of the first scientists to actually bring back a near extinct animal. And so once again, our special guest today is Dr. Robert Lanza, a leading figure in biotechnology.
Well, as a young boy, I was rarely allowed outside the house. So I was on my own, and I went to the ponds to catch snapping turtles and would climb trees to catch screech owls and flying squirrels. And so I'd go on these long trips trying to figure out the universe. And even at that age, I was in awe at the world. But unfortunately, my parents and none of my sisters had finished high school, so I, too, was placed in this slow class with the kids that used to throw the spitball. So I came up with this plan.
I know that.
Yeah. So I came up with this plan to prove myself. And actually, at that time, Watson and Crick had just cracked the genetic code just a few years earlier. So I decided to carry out what amounts to genetic engineering.
As a kid?
Yes. I was actually a teenager. I was around 14. And I had actually seen a black squirrel, and so I wanted to see whether I could make it albino or vice versa. And so I went to my biology teacher, and he told me that it was impossible, and everyone laughed at me. But I was determined to prove him wrong, so I went into my basement, and I figured out actually how to alter the genetic makeup of a white chicken to make him black by transferring genes from the pigmented chicken. And my mother thought I was just trying to hatch chicken eggs. So I decided, you know, to really prove this, I really needed to work with someone who understood that stuff. So, you know, to me, the greatest place on the planet was Harvard Medical School. So I saved up my nickels and dimes and took the buses and trolleys into Boston. And it actually took me half a day to get there. I didn't even know where I was going. So I tried to go in through the front door, and the guard didn't let me. It was sort of like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz, you know, when the palace guard said, "Go away." But rather than leaving, I went around the back and I waited by the Dipsy dumpster, and I saw this little short, bald guy walking up with khaki pants and a bunch of keys. And I thought, oh, here's the janitor. So he opens the door and I just sort of slip in. And a little way down the corridor, he says, "Well, can I help you, sir?" And I said, "No, I'm looking for a Harvard doctor." Now, what I didn't know was that was Steven Kuffler, chairman of the neurobiology department. He had just been nominated for the Nobel Prize.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I thought that he was just the janitor, and so I told him that I was friends with the janitor down the street from me, and that I worked in the cafeteria. And so he asked me why I was there, and I said I was trying to, you know, alter the genetic makeup of a white chicken. And then I went on, you know, explaining about DNA, thinking, you know, he doesn't have a clue. And then he actually said, "Well, I know someone that can help you." And he brought me upstairs, you know, past all the spaghetti wire and all to Josh Sains, who now runs actually the Brain Center at Harvard. And he was just a grad student at the time. So after talking with Josh all day, they invited me back to repeat those experiments. And the work was ultimately published in Nature in 1974. And every now and then I would go back and the janitor would show up. And I was always so excited to see him. And it wasn't until later that I realized who he was. So that was actually how I got into the hard science.
And where did you get the equipment for your high school project interfering with the genes of living organisms? Where did you get your equipment?
Well, it was really very challenging. You know, you have to remember I was just a little boy, very short. I didn't look very old. And, you know, I'd be trying to get syringes. So I'd be at the hospitals trying to convince the doctors to give me syringes. And then I would go to another hospital and convince them and to give me penicillin. And there was actually a gentleman who actually worked at one of the state labs who had a centrifuge in his cellar. So I put these all together and managed over a period of time to figure out how to do it in a very crude way.
So you created your own biotech laboratory in your basement?
Yeah, right next to the
kid?
Furnace. My mother actually had no idea I was doing it.
Amazing. You know, when I was a kid, I built an atom smasher in my garage.
You're kidding.
Yeah, I had to go to Westinghouse.
So you understand.
Yeah, I went to Westinghouse to get 400 pounds of transformer steel and 22 miles of copper wire.
Wow.
To build a 2.3 million electron volt betatron in the garage. And you, as a kid, was out there meddling with the genes of living organisms.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was a fun time.
Okay. Well, moving on now, let's talk about cloning. We've heard so much about cloning in the media. Arnold Schwarzenegger even had a movie where he met his clone, and the whole movie was based on criminal clones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is a clone, and how far are we in terms of being able to clone animals, primates, and maybe even humans?
Well, cloning is conceptually very simple. You basically take the cell from the animal you want to clone and put it next to an empty egg, that has had all of its DNA removed. And then you send an electrical charge through the two cells, and they fuse. So when the cells fuse, the DNA from the cell you want to clone is dumped into the empty egg. And another approach is just to inject the DNA directly into the empty egg. The next step is to use chemicals then to fool that egg into thinking it's been fertilized. And so then this cell starts to divide, and you end up with an embryo that can then be placed in a surrogate mother. And then if everything goes well, you can end up with a genetically identical copy of the animal you want to clone. And, of course, you know, we've cloned at this point many dozens of species. We've cloned endangered species, glow-in-the-dark mice, whole herds of cows. In fact, there have been many farm animals, goats, pigs, cows, and even pets such as cats and dogs.
Now, we had a chance to interview Ian Wilmut, the Scottish scientist who actually cloned Dolly. Explain to us exactly what he did. What was Dolly, and was Dolly premature age? There was some controversy about that.
Well, yes. Ian Wilmut was the first to actually clone a mammal from an adult cell. And so he actually took a cell and went through the methodology I just described, and then that DNA was placed into an empty egg from another sheep. And when Dolly was born, everyone thought, because of the length of the telomeres, and these are the ends of the chromosomes that determine how many times a cell can divide, we all thought that cloning Dolly was basically an older sheep, in disguise. And so what we actually did is published a paper in 2000 that actually showed that wasn't the case, that you can actually start out with an old senescent cell that's decrepit, and the cloning procedure actually restores that cell to a youthful state and allows it once again to start dividing into an entire organism. So it actually turns out in the end, using not only just sheep, but also cows and mice, it's been shown repeatedly now that, in fact, cloning is like a little time machine. You can actually rejuvenate that DNA and actually end up with youthful cells.
So, in other words, you are literally turning back the biological clock, resetting it back to zero when this clone is born.
Absolutely. In fact, in some of the experiments we did, we actually were able to turn it back even more so that the cells actually had twice the lifespan that they normally should. So, again, the process is very irregular, so there's a possibility that, you know, that they may actually live shorter or longer, and a lot of that depends on many factors.
So, in other words, the cloned animal, in some sense, may actually be an improved version of the original animal with longer telomeres?
Well, certainly at the cellular level, we know that that is the case. Now, you know, obviously aging is very complex. There are other environmental factors that go into it. But certainly at the cellular level, we know that in some of these experiments, we actually have cells that lived quite extensively longer.
Okay. Now, what kinds of animals have been cloned? I understand that pets have been cloned, and I even went to Dallas, Texas with a film crew from BBC Television, where we went to a ranch where we saw clones of clones of clones, and one series of animals, we had like eight animal calves all lined up in a line. They were all identical twins. So what kinds of animals have been cloned?
Well, the list is quite extensive, starting from mice, rats, and rabbits. Again, all of the various farm animals, goats, pigs, horses. In fact, we created an entire herd of cows that actually was making human proteins in their milk that were genetically modified. On top of that, of course, there are multiple different endangered species that have now been cloned. So in theory, virtually every mammal should in the future be able to be cloned.
Now, in the newspapers, every once in a while, some oddball announces that he's done the first human clone. However, as I understand, no primate has been successfully cloned. What's the status with regards to cloning primates and humans?
Well, as you point out, cloning primates, including humans, has been problematic. You know, back in 2001, we were the first group to clone the first early stage of human embryos, and we were doing that for generating stem cells, not for reproductive purposes. And even to this date, the technique isn't perfected. Of course, there was the Wong scandal where for a while we thought that someone had that technique worked out. In fact, just a few months ago, we published a scientific paper where we showed for the first time that human cloning can't actually successfully reprogram human cells back to a normal embryonic state, and we're still working on that.
Now let's talk about your work, which is nothing less than fantastic. First of all, with endangered animals, you've been able to essentially bring back to life, genetically speaking, organisms that have been dead for 25 years. Explain your work.
Well, as you know, about 100 species go extinct every day, and those genes are lost from the planet forever. And so seeing that we're the ones that cause most of these extinctions, a while back I thought that, well, perhaps, you know, we had some responsibility to see if we could use some of our tools the best we can to reverse that. So back in 2000, I actually decided I would try to clone a gaur, which is an endangered ox-like creature from Asia, and it had been hunted almost to the verge of extinction. And I actually got some cells that from an animal that had died a few years earlier and tried to clone it using ordinary domestic cow eggs. And many of my colleagues said, well, Bob, that's impossible. You can't get a clone. You can't clone one species using the eggs from another species. And it turned out we actually were able to generate a beautiful little baby gaur embryos. We actually sent them off to IOR by FedEx Overnight Express, and they were implanted into ordinary farm cows. And 9 months later, we got a baby gaur, which we called Noah. It was born alive, walking around and bellowing. But then a couple days later, it died of dysentery. So everyone said, see, Bob, it doesn't work. So I went back to the San Diego Zoo and convinced them to, you know, let's give this a try again. So they said, well, you know, we actually have this what we call stud 391 that died back in 1980, a quarter of a century earlier. And he said, it would be great if you could bring that animal, resurrect that animal, so we could reintroduce that valuable genetic material into our highly inbred group of animals that they had. So they sent me a vial of these cells, and we transferred them into some empty cow eggs, and they were sent off again to IOR and implanted in some beef cattle that served as the surrogate moms. And we started with 16 pregnancies, and 9 months later, we were down to just two. And so there we were back in 2003. We were secretly gathered out in this farm out in the middle of nowhere, and we were watching this cow give birth by C-section. And I remember, you know, that, you know, when they started the C-section, there was some splatting of blood, and the vet reached in and pulled out from the mother's belly, you know, these two small hooves. And when they started to massage it, you know, suddenly its eyes opened and its ears started to wiggle, and it let out this big bellow, and everyone applauded. And the whole thing was so surreal. Here we were out in a farm in Iowa watching a beef cow give birth to this exotic endangered animal that's normally born in the bamboo jungles of Southeast Asia. It was really exciting.
Now, since then, I guess many other people have followed in your footsteps, right? So I guess many endangered animals have been brought back.
Yes, that is correct. And just recently in South Korea, I understand that they cloned an endangered wolf. You know, the hope is we've actually been in dialogue, you know, with some folks in China about the giant panda. But also, too, work is now going on to clone cheetahs and even the extinct Bucato mountain goat.
Now, I understand that the competition is so fierce that in South Korea, one of their leading researchers was tempted to commit fraud and basically faked all his papers claiming these fantastic results. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, actually, back at the early part of this decade, we actually, you know, there was an article on the cover of Wired where we were on the verge. We actually had cloned a pretty advanced stage human embryo. And at the time, everyone thought it was imminent that we were going to be publishing actually creating stem cells. And then just out of the blue, this group in South Korea, which no one had any knowledge of, published a paper in Science saying they had done it. So obviously, this individual thought he could do it, and his name was Wong. And unfortunately, it turned out many years later that the whole thing had been fabricated. It was just a complete disaster. You know, it actually, you know, terminated most of the research we were doing. Everyone had just assumed that this feat had been accomplished. You know, it was one of the biggest scandals in scientific history. It was just terrible.
And in fact, some of my colleagues were wondering why he did it to disgrace the whole country, because at some point it would come out. However, the leading theory is that he probably thought that some group around the world was going to do it anyway. So why not simply beat them out by a few months to a few years, and then people will forget. People will overlook things and not go into the details and find out that he was a total fraud.
No, absolutely. I know he was convinced that in a few months we were going to publish a paper showing we could do it, and then everyone would say, see, it works. And, you know, and then he would have gone on and got his Nobel Prize. And in fact, the government gave him millions and millions of dollars and literally thousands of human eggs. And so I'm sure he was certain that he would be able to achieve it and no one would ever know. In fact, he pulled into his group, you know, some of the top cloning experts in the world, you know, Shatton and even Ian Wilmot in the end was working with him. So I'm sure he figured out with all of the brain power and resources that this would be pretty simple to do. And as you know, it's turned out to be a lot more difficult than anyone thought.
Now, let's talk about something that is science fiction,
okay.
Bringing back extinct animals, including the Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
On this show, we've had people that are very interested in sequencing the genome of the Neanderthal, our nearest species, which died out tens of thousands of years ago in Europe. And believe it or not, they expect the full genome of the Neanderthal to be sequenced in the coming years. And there's talk about maybe bringing back the Neanderthals. Any comments?
Yeah, I think that, you know, on many of these, you know, extinct species, including the Neanderthal and dinosaurs, that at some point in the future, we may have that technology. I think, you know, even today, I know, like, for instance, when you come to my house, I have this 6-foot brontosaurus bone that weighs 800 pounds. And, you know, it's from one of the largest dinosaurs that ever roamed the earth. And the first thing everyone asks me is, Bob, are you going to clone this? And I tell them, you can't clone from stone. You need living cells, or certainly the tissue. And as you mentioned, once we have the genome, we may be able to incorporate that into a living cell. Now, the thing to remember is that it's a little more complicated than that because there's two genomes in the cell, the mitochondrial genome, and that has to talk with the nuclear genome. So that presents a bit of a problem because even if you have the DNA for, you know, the species itself, what determines you or the Neanderthal or the dinosaur, you still need to figure out how to get that to be able to interact with the maternally transferred genetics. So, again, you know, I always say that you're not going to be seeing dinosaurs in your backyard anytime soon. Again, the Neanderthal tissue as well as the mammoth that was unearthed a few years ago, you have to realize that after years of freezing and thawing, that there have been holes poked in the animal's DNA. And right now, molecular biologists don't know how to fill in the gaps. And the same thing applies, I think, to the Tasmanian tiger, which died out in the 1930s in Australia. But I think someday we are going to learn how to either sequence the entire genome or to repair the DNA. But again, that's going to be many years off.
Now, with the woolly mammoth, we've actually had several people involved in that project on exploration. Mm-hmm. And they tell me that if you extract DNA from the carcasses of these animals that died thousands and thousands of years ago in Siberia, you just get fragments, little pieces here and there all over the place, and it's pretty hard to make sense out of it. However, with computers, we're going to get very good at putting pieces together and having the computer put the jigsaw puzzle together. So what do you think? Maybe one day a computer using what is called bioinformatics,
mm-hmm.
you think they may be able to piece it together using, let's say, a blueprint of an elephant genome?
I think absolutely. I think we have a lot of tricks in our toolbox, something known as homologous recombination, which would allow us to go in and splice the genes right in precisely where we'd like them. And there are some newer techniques evolving. And then, of course, you would require a very powerful computer, seeing that I think someone once compared it to shredding up the New York phone directory into little pieces and then having to reassemble it. But with computers, as you know, they're very powerful and we're discovering new tricks. So I think sometime in the future, yes, that we definitely should be able to do this.
Now, about 2 months ago, I did a book tour in London and I went to Oxford. I had dinner with Richard Dawkins, one of the leading biologists in the world. And he's on record as stating that perhaps one day we'll be able to take the genome of a human, compare it to the genome of a chimpanzee, analyze the genes that are different, and then with a computer program, interpolate between them in order to get the best approximation for the genome of the missing link, Australopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, he says this is an outrageous idea.
Mm-hmm.
He's very careful to say that. But it's an idea that can't be ruled out. You have any thoughts about such an outrageous idea as one day bringing back not just a Neanderthal, but the missing link?
I think all that is possible in the future. There's no question about it. Once we have the tools to manipulate the genetics, you know, already today we know how to knock out genes, for instance, to increase the muscle mass of an animal to twice its original amount. So I think we already have some of those tools, and we're adding them very quickly. So yes, I think it could be done, but as you mentioned, I think there's this ethical concern that it will probably prevent it from occurring. I mean, even when we, you know, generated the first cloned embryo, even for medical purposes, I mean, it was a huge outcry. It's very, very controversial. So, yes, in theory, I think we will eventually have the scientific tools to do it. The question will be, should we?
And speaking about ethics and the dark side, maybe you saw the movie The Island. In that movie, it's a very dark plot. People find out, much to their shock, that they are actually clones of a real person. They didn't realize that they were imposters. They always thought they were real humans. Mm-hmm. But they were cloned in order to harvest the organs of their body. In other words, they were raised to be killed, mm-hmm. so that the organs of their body could be harvested and then given to a rich man who actually paid big bucks to have their body cloned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you can't clone memories. That's mm-hmm. not possible. But do you think that is the way some people are going to go? Or you think we'll simply grow organs separately from having to clone the entire body?
Yeah, well, I think there's a consensus in the medical and scientific community that you would never allow any kind of a clone to go past the first several days of cell division. So it would be smaller than, you know, the head of a pin. So I think what we would do is what we're doing now is you would create embryonic stem cells or what we call now iPS cells for pluripotent stem cells. And those cells are immortal and they grow. And we can now turn those into virtually every cell type in the body. And through a new techniques that are developing in a field known as tissue engineering, we can reconstitute those into more complex tissues and structures. In fact, I published a paper with Tony et al. A number of years ago where we actually used clone cells from a cow to grow in the lab kidneys that actually were able to remove toxic materials when we transplanted them back into the animal they were cloned from. And those cells were very smart. They had assembled into the glomeruli, into all the various elements of the kidney. And since that time, work has been done to grow in the lab entire bladders that have been used in patients. And in fact, there's work now where people have actually created primitive beating hives using this tissue engineering technique. So one day you're going to go to the hospital, we'll take a skin cell, and we'll just grow you up a new kidney or whatever you need.
And speaking about that, I went with a film crew from BBC Television down to Wake Forest University, where you're also a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually went through Tony et al.'s laboratory where we photographed heart valves that are opening and closing, opening and closing. Heart valves that were grown from your own cells.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can grow bladders. The first windpipe was grown recently. Now, where is it going to go? Are we going to be able to grow, for example, a liver? If that happens, think of all the people who die because they don't get a liver in time, like Mickey Mantle, the great baseball giant, died of liver failure.
Mm-hmm.
Is the liver, the pancreas, are they coming?
Absolutely. We're making enormous progress on tissue engineering virtually every organ system in the body, including bones and tendons. And also, too, we're now on the forefront of what we now are able to do is to actually a new paradigm in medicine where we're able to actually generate early developmental cells that only exist transiently in the embryo and use them to repair the adult body almost like nanoparticles. So, for instance, we published a paper a couple of years ago where we created what we call these hemangioblasts, and they were like ambulance cells. And when we injected them into the body, we found that in animals that had had massive heart attacks, that it actually cut the death rate in half, a simple injection. Or in animals where, for instance, they would otherwise have their legs amputated due to lack of blood flow, we completely restored the blood flow by injecting these cells. In the same manner, the liver, we believe we have cells that will be able to repair that. So I think in the next few years, you're going to see a lot more of this work published. And yes, I think you're going to be able to repair virtually any worn out or dysfunctional tissue in the body.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Lanza, who is one of the pioneers in biotechnology. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we discussed the relationship between science and religion, and we talked about how perhaps science may one day explain the origin of religion, at least religion as it's practiced here on the planet Earth. And then in the second half of Exploration, we talked about evolution and biotechnology. Now, again, science is a sword. It's a sword that depends on who wields the sword. On one hand, if it's wielded by powers that be, perhaps we'll have wars, ignorance, poverty, and disease. However, if the sword of science is wielded by the people, we could usher in an age of plenty. The promise of biotechnology is considerable. I mean, think about it. Being able to eliminate many of the diseases that afflict the human race. Able to relieve the suffering of millions of people. And because we have an aging population, we have a new set of diseases like cancer and heart disease and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, all of which inflict tremendous suffering on the people of the world. And so we have the tremendous promise of biotechnology. Also the promise that one day we'll be able to bioengineer foods that can alleviate hunger. I mean, think about it for a moment. One day perhaps we'll be able to create super rice, a variety of rice that can flourish in the desert and in harsh environments and feed the poor. So the promise of biotechnology is many, but hey, let's be honest, there's also a possibility that one day, perhaps something could escape from the laboratory and create havoc around the world. There's also that danger as well. Well, that's it for Exploration. And once again, if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.